All right. This is Bob King and Gary Johnson.
Same.
We're doing an interview, actually, for an oral history interview for the NN Cannery History Project. And this will be in cooperation with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Oral History program.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about the history of the NN Cannery, where you were superintendent for many, many years and the like. This is the intent of this is just to gain more historical data about the history, the people who worked at it, and the like. But the intent of the recording is to share with the university and other researchers, writers, scholars, and the like, and the interested public. The university may make this available publicly through the various programs. There's a lot of interest in oral histories from around the state, and we haven't printed it out, but we'll have you sign a release form at the at the end. But again, this is totally voluntary on your part, and you're free to if you choose don't want to answer a question or whatever. It's
when you talk about history, I didn't think I was that old. So, what kind of history do I have?
Well, you've actually, the stories that people tell and that they remember are really important. And I mean, just yesterday when we were, did I give the date? It's October 8th, 2018. And it's a little after 3 in the afternoon. We're at Katie Johnson Ringman's home in Eagle River.
Yeah.
So all that's good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go and let's start. And first, it's we've talked a couple times just yesterday, mm-hmm. and I was also down there passing through Arizona a few years ago, and we chatted about the history and there are a lot of Alaskans, especially interested in the history of the fishing industry itself, and as well as the and some of the specific canneries, including the NN Cannery.
Mm-hmm.
But first, to get started, tell me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up. You said you grew up on a farm, right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Centralia, Washington, and it's just south of Olympia a little ways. And that's where I went to grade school, and from there my dad worked in the woods in addition to having a farm. So I'd get up in the morning and go down and get the eggs, the egg house, and feed the cattle, get those ready for milking at night and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And then my grandfather was a dairy farmer of the year in Washington, and so I spent a lot of time on the farms. But really, most of the time I was in the river swimming. I worked, but you know, not like you'd think a regular farmer would work, because I wasn't very old then. I was probably about 10 to 12 years old. So,
right.
You know, I was goofing off more than anything. So.
But then you moved to
other communities? Then I moved to, from there, we went up to Port Angeles, and my dad had a sawmill up there. And he burned out, and so we moved to Port Townsend after that, and he bought a bowling alley. So I spent most of my time helping out in the bowling alley. So before school, I'd go and clean it up and get ready to do the alleys and dress the alleys and wait on customers. And then during the summertime, my mom and dad would take off for vacation, and I'd be left alone. Not left alone, but I'd be left responsible for the bowling alley. So all the people and getting the machines ready to go. And if there's any breakdowns, hopefully I could fix them. But most of the time, you know, I had to wait until Dad got home. But I went to start the college, and my roommate of all people, his name was Denny Andrews, was from Kodiak Island. And then all of a sudden, we heard, and Denny did, is an earthquake in Alaska. Uh-huh. And that was the year of the earthquake, and I believe that was 1964?
Correct.
And so, anyway, Denny had to go back home because, you know, he lived in Kodiak where the big Saners were right up in the middle of town. And so we listened to the news and everything like that, and they said, stay out of Alaska, stay out of Alaska. There's no jobs, you know, it's the earthquake and all, and tidal waves. And so anyway, I had $100 in my pocket and a round trip ticket to Alaska. And I went up there and I went to work at 8 o'clock the following morning for Kodiak King Crab, right in Kodiak. It was packing crab. So I did that, and I figured it up that the only money I was gonna make was maybe the last week I was there. And I got to spend another almost 2 months here, and I was only going to make enough money in 1 week. So anyway, I went down to job services and applied for packing fish for Fish and Game. Well, I don't know if you realize, but when you work for government, you have to fill out 1 million pieces of paper. And I was just getting ready to finish the last one, and the lady from job services came in and says, Gary, there's a job out at Larson Bay as a storekeeper. Would you be interested? It's free room and board. And that's all I heard was free room and board. I didn't care how much money I was going to make or anything like that. All I knew is I was going to be fed. So anyway, go out there. And after about a week, they had our time cards and stuff like that. I found out I was making less than minimum wage. And so they had to bump us up. And that summer I was making $1.09 an hour. And I worked for about 2.5 months in the store during the day, and then going out in the cannery and working the tail off at night when nobody else was around, you know, because I was not very old. You know, I think I was 18, 19 years old. And so I worked all that time, and I took home a little over $1,000. I made more money in Larson Bay in that short period of time than I did in Port Townsend working the Crown Z paper mill for the whole summer. And I thought it was pretty good, you know. And so that was my start in the fish industry. We were helping out Saners, you know, and putting up grocery orders. In those days, you know, you're talking about 1963-4, and I was putting up $300-$400 orders for grub for just five guys to go out for a fishing period. And you know, it was a lot of fun, you know. Well, you know, we'd have we'd mark the produce and or the cans, you know, like three for a dollar, and the normal price was 33 cents anyway, and we hit $3-4. So we did a lot of screwy bad, not real bad things, but that's one thing I could remember that we did. And the guy looked at it and he says, it's $3-4, and the normal price is 33 cents. What's the deal here? So anyway, we used to have a lot of fun, and we'd catch halibut off the end of the dock. I mean, there was one that was taller than me. Had to pull it up with a winch on the one of the Saners. And then we'd go out on the dock and take our fishing poles and fish for humpies. And they'd be schooling up around there, and we'd catch humpies. We must catch 25, 30 fish during lunch hour, you know, off the end of the the dock. Not the dock, but the where the ramp or where the waves were. And we had gooses, which is an amphibious airplane, would come in, they'd come up, and we had to go down and help the mail, because the mail was held in the office or in the store. And so the storekeeper was the mail clerk on top of everything. She worked for the post office and for the store. And I was only an assistant storekeeper, so I wasn't even called a storekeeper. So anyway, I went back to Larson Bay for 3 years. And then from there, I was in Bellingham, Washington. My wife just graduated from Seattle U, and we moved up to Bellingham, and I was going to school at the Western Washington State School up there. And lo and behold, about January, February, somewhere around there, ran out of money. So I was eating oatmeal for 3 weeks. And so anyway, I drove from Bellingham, Washington, up to Blaine, Washington, the home of Alaska Packers, who I worked for in Larson Bay. And I says, do you have any jobs? And they said, sure, we have a job. We can send you up as an assistant bookkeeper in Naknek, Alaska. So I went up there. Jim Canavan was my bookkeeper, and I helped him do the books for that first year. And then they promoted me, and I was the head bookkeeper in Pilot Point the next year. And that was probably 68. And then in 69, I went back to Naknek as a, oh no, back to Igigig as a head bookkeeper. And I was there that year. And then I stayed in Blaine for a couple of years because they said you couldn't take families to Alaska. And I says, well, if I can't take family to Alaska, I'm not gonna go. So anyway, a couple years later, they changed the rules and they sent me to Naknek as a head bookkeeper. And I took my daughter and she slept in a 48 tall salmon box. That's where she, because her crib didn't make it on the tender, get it up there by the time we got up there. So she spent her first summer in a salmon box sleeping. And I don't know if that's why she was so interested in fish salmon. But anyway, I spent a couple years as a bookkeeper. And then they made me assistant superintendent at Naknek. And Tom Takioka was the superintendent in those days. And his original job before he came to Alaska Packers, he was worked for Food and Drug. So since I was the assistant superintendent, he was the superintendent, he wanted me to learn things that Food and Drug would come and talk about. So he sent me to possibly every school that you could possibly go to. You know, I learned how to clean up cannery, smell fish. I went to school to, you know, you had to train your nose. And I had one of the more sensitive noses in the industry because I could smell rotten fish. I remember one time at the cannery, we was just before the season started. I walked down the fish house and we had processed a few kings and butchered them by hand, and that was about it. We hadn't operated any machines, but I walked in and I could smell fish. And I had the cleanup crew clean up the fish house again. And so they got it all cleaned up and they called me back down. I come down there and I could still smell rotten fish. So I said, what in the heck? So anyway, they looked around, and they found what happened was a head of one of the kings that we butchered had hung up in the gurry trough, and it was rotting under there. It hung up on one of the edges of the flume. And so we all kind of patted ourselves on the back, and they took care of it, cleaned it up better. Never had any problem with that, and those kids did a good job the rest of the season. Never had to worry about smelling fish again.
That's a great nose you have.
Oh, yeah. Well, I used to say, you know, and I invite people into the mess hall to have dinner or whatever, lunch, and I says, look, if we go out to the outside the cannery, if we go into the cannery, and if you can smell fish, any kind of fish, I'll buy you dinner. Because fresh fish has no odor, believe it or not. And so, you know, you go in the cannery and we had no, now if you stepped outside and looked over the docks and stuff like that, you could smell fish because they're floating up and down the river. But you go in the cannery and you could not smell fish. Not in my cannery anyway, because we had some of the good and best cleanup kids that were. They spent a lot of time you know, they'd go work, you know, at midnight after we're done canning, and then they'd get done by, oh, 6 o'clock in the morning if they're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, and they always did a good job.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me back you up just a little bit and talk about when you're working as a bookkeeper and in places like Pilot Point and Igigig, and Larson Bay. But what's the role of the cannery store in remote communities like that? Don't they have an important role? Where there are no Walmarts?
And well, basically, yeah, they are. Because when we ran our stores in Pilot Point and the other one, you know, we had traps for sale. We had ammunition. We had guns, shotguns and 30-06s and stuff like that. You know, it was a Walmart. You know, we had groceries and cans, Del Monte mainly, fruit and vegetables and stuff like that. But we had all the other stuff, and we had battery chargers and you know, power saws and, you know, basically anything you could probably buy at Walmart, even more so, we sold in the company stores. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ray Soderlund was in charge of the stores for Alaska Packers during the early days. And he had a nickname. They called him Soda Pop. Dickie Day, who was the winterman at Igigig, tagged Ray Soderlund as they called him Soda Pop, because he always ordered Soda Pop, and, you know, and he had it there at the cannery. So it was one of those things that, you know, I finally just remembered it just a second ago when you asked me about the stores.
Right. Well, yeah, they really played a big role.
Oh, yeah. And then at the end of the season, we'd have grub sticks. And they'd give us a big list of stuff. And one of the jobs of the assistant storekeeper, we had to go through and put all this stuff together. And, you know, you're talking about in the old days, I don't know how much a dollar was worth as opposed to, but, you know, you're talking about $3,000 or $4,000 a grub steak sometimes. And, of course, we take it right off the fish pay. But, you know, that's a lot of food, because they had to last them for the whole winter. And, you know, the Alaskan people, you know, they didn't have just one kid. You usually had two or three, or more than like five or six. So, you know, they had, and then they had aunts and uncles and stuff like that. So they went through a lot of food. And the better fishermen had bigger grub sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the people who you met. You mentioned Alf Nelson.
Yeah, Alf Nelson was a superintendent in the Bay prior to me meeting him. And then I don't know exactly why, but he ended up in Larson Bay as kind of a superintendent assistant, because Pete Marinkovich was the superintendent and Alf was there helping him. And at night, after 9 o'clock, we would always sit around the table and play poker. And Alf Nelson was one of the poker players. And we played poker until about midnight. You know, nothing's big gambling games and stuff like that. And it wasn't penny ante, it was nickel dime stuff. But he would always talk about Bristol Bay. That's all he would talk about, was Bristol Bay, how they did this, how they did that. And, you know, we didn't get sick and tired of it because we enjoyed him. You know, and he was neat to listen to. And he would tell us about some of the old fishermen, how they'd go out. Sam Papetti would go out and nobody would be catching fish or anything. And he'd go out there and look around and throw his net overboard and sink it right away. You know, and nobody else would keep catching fish. And here Sam Papetti would load up and, you know, and stuff like that. You know, and it was just really neat to listen to the guy. And like I say, when I met Alf, I was probably, that was the second year I was up there. So I was 19 and very impressionable. And I wanted to learn as much as I could. And I listened like a little kid for everything he said, you know, and he gave me some pictures years later when he owned, they bought Iggy from Alaska Packers, and he was in charge of it, and he gave me some pictures of the old sailing ship days when they were going out to sea, and the sailing ship with the three masts, you know, what are they called,
schooners,
barks.
Yeah.
But anyway, there was four of them that had been leaving Bristol Bay at that time, and they were headed for San Francisco, and he gave me a picture of that.
Oh, that's great.
I can still remember it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure exactly, but I'm pretty sure he passed away here a few years ago. So.
You mentioned Dickie Day, and I never met him, but I actually have one of his hats from Igigik. I think Igigik 1981.
Well, when it was Diamond E?
Right.
Yeah. But I remember one time I was sitting there working on my books. This is, I was a bookkeeper in Igigik, and Dickie Day comes rushing into my office, and he says, Gary, they're getting ready to take maple bars out of the oven. You know, when I say oven, they're great big things. You know, they go up and around and up and through. By the time they come out, they're cooked. But anyway, we went there and there was four of us, and we started eating maple bars. I ate 12 maple bars, and I came in third place. So, and Dickie was ahead of everybody.
I see a maple bar over there, actually, if you want it. But that's really great. Who else was I going to ask about? Anyway, when did you become... Norm Rockness that I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
He was the superintendent when you
was
first joined...
Was a bookkeeper,
Yeah. At the NN Canner.
Yeah, I was there from, 67, 68, 69. And then I stayed a couple years in Blaine when they wouldn't let families go north. And then I went back, and I believe it was probably 70, somewhere around there, that I went back to Naknek as a bookkeeper. And Norm Marcus was a superintendent.
Tell me about Norm.
I shouldn't say. Norm Rockness, everybody talked about Norm Rockness, how he was the superintendent. He was the longest tenured superintendent that Alaska Packers ever had, and he did this stuff and that way. Well, come to find out, by the time I got done, I spent four more years as a superintendent than Norm Rockness ever did. He had a boy, his name was, I forget, but he was an airline pilot for Alaska Airlines, and he was about my age, and he and I used to have a lot of fun, because he would come up and fish a little conversion that Norm Rockness owned, and it was called The Rock, and it was Pete Rockness, and Pete would get that boat and go out and fish and catch fish. He was not a good fisherman, but he wasn't a bad fisherman. But, you know, he'd come up after putting in some time on the airplanes, and then he'd go out and fish for a little while, and then he'd pick up, his dad would pick up the boat and put it in the warehouse, and Pete would fly home and start flying airplanes, big ones.
You mentioned earlier Tom Takioka.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he was the quality control guy who became superintendent after Norm, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was the superintendent right after Norm passed away. And he's the one that sent me to all these quality control classes and fish and game and everything I can remember. The only thing that was really neat about it is we ate ourselves up and down the West Coast. Because Tom loved to stop into restaurants and have lunch and stuff like that. Didn't put on any weight, but we just, you know, and he was a good cook. He knew about Burger King as being better than McDonald's because they had a flame broil. And, you know, that's why I learned how to eat hamburgers. I used to eat hamburgers from Burger King as opposed to McDonald's, because McDonald's was fried and he didn't like fried. And, And so that's the way we ran our cannery too. So, and he taught me a lot and sent me to enough schools that I learned, hopefully I learned quite a bit. But when we had people and my supervisors at the cannery, they did the things. I made the joke, they either did it my way or the highway. Well, my way was way I was taught with the Food and Drug and all the buyers from the Orient and or the UK would come over and give us thoughts and ideas and how to do things. So I was taking all this stuff in as assistant superintendent as well as assistant or superintendent. And like I say, all the people that worked for me, I tried to pass on all the information that I had. And like I said and joked, it was either my way or the highway. And what I really should say, it was either the right way or, you know, because the quality control people were responsible and they had the things to do. And my machinist boss, the quality control people, they all were answering to me. And they backed me up and I backed them up. And so when they had problems in the cannery, if they couldn't handle it themselves, guess who they came to? And you know, we made sure we got it done. And normally we didn't have any problems because everybody was on the same boat.
Yeah.
We wanted to do that, we wanted to make that cannery. We took a cannery that wasn't what you would call really a good one and made it one of the better canneries in Bristol Bay. And we had people that were very proud of that. And one of them was their superintendent. So we had a lot of praise from the buyers. And I used to say that, you know, when the buyers came in, I used to, or when Food and Drug would come in, I'd say, whisper, Food and Drug's here. So they'd go around and tell all my supervisors that Food and Drug is here, we got to make sure we do things right. Well, lo and behold, somebody would drop a fish on the floor and throw it back on the sliming table or whatever. And that wasn't the way they were taught. So after about two or three trips of going this way, I finally decided I'm not going to tell anybody when Food and Drug was there. So after that, never had any problem because the people did it the way they were taught, which was the right way. And so we never had any trouble with Food and Drug or people. Yeah, they dropped fish on the floor, but they washed them off and did it right way to put before they put them back on the sliming table. Yeah. So
sounds like they were, when during the year that Tom was superintendent, they were sort of grooming you for the job.
Well, I don't know about that. I think I got it because nobody else wanted it. But no, I think they might have been doing it.
Sounds like they were.
I know Tom was very encouraging, and some of my bosses and I didn't see eye to eye on everything, you know. And a lot of it was what I was taught, and what Tom taught me, and what they didn't know. You know, and it's kind of aggravating. You got a boss coming in and trying to tell you what to do, and it's wrong. You know, and that's why when I ran the cannery, I never got in anybody's face, you know, unless they were, you know. But we had supervisors meetings every day at 11:07. And all my floor supervisors, whether they were in the can shop, the fish house, egg house, whatever, they were always required to come to that meeting. And they had downtime reports and reports that they filled out at the end of the day. And so what I do is I go at night, I go through all of these and I pick out something on everybody, not everybody, but somebody's downtime report or whatever. And then during the supervisors meeting, I'd ask them about it. And, you know, just have them explain it to me. And that so everybody filled out our their paperwork the way they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. And we had, at 11:07, everybody knew where I was, my office staff and everything like that. So when my bosses or Mr. Bunren, would call up and want to know where I was, and it was 11:07. They said he's at a supervisor's meeting, and nobody interrupted my supervisor's meeting, because that was where the whole cannery was brought together every day, and we dealt with our problems that we had. And we most of the time, we start at 11:07, and we wouldn't even get done until in the lunchtime. And then we'd go to lunch, and then we'd come back, and then they'd start their business. And we did that, well, I don't know for how many years I was superintendent, but probably after about, I didn't start it until about the fourth or fifth year I was a superintendent. So, because you can't change and do everything all at once. You know, especially when you have supervisors and had people that were bosses that didn't read or write English. And it makes it tough. You know, you say, well, give them a downtime report. They had no idea what we were talking about. You know, and you're supposed to look at your watch and say how long the machine wasn't running and try to explain it. And if not, then we take it to the machinist boss and say, hey, you were down for 5 minutes at such and such down, and they said it was because of this and this. What was the problem? So, you know, whether it was lack of fish, a cans got jammed, you know, and stuff like that. So we all worked together to find out the problem. And like I say, we tried to make sure that machine was running a minimum of 80% every day, all day long. All the machines. If it wasn't running 80%, we had something down on the downtime report to try to explain it, why it wasn't running 80%. But most of the time, quote unquote, it was always better than 80%.
So. Tell me, you know, it sounds like there's never an average day at the cannery, but what was your routine like as a cannery superintendent to keep it operational, to keep your people happy, to keep it working?
Well, basically, it's hard to say. It's from you got people problem, or try to keep the people, and supervisors to keep the people happy. And the biggest thing I found out is leave them alone and let them do the job. I hire these people to do a job. So what I did is try to stay out of their way and let them do what they were hired to do. And that's usually what happened. You know, if they had problems, they come to me. If they had any problems with their employees or something like that, they come to me. But if they were doing their daily routine maintenance and job, I didn't want to know what they were doing. All I wanted to know is, was the machines doing 80% or better? And was the people happy? Because they had to work with the people on the line and keep them happy. So, you know, they had to wear safety goggles all the time, the hair nets, they had to have their hair nets in place. They had to have their boots on. You know, and so I couldn't go down and patrol all that stuff. And my quality control people were checking the seams and the cans and stuff like that, so they really didn't have time. But my machinists who were watching the machines, they could watch the people and see, so they had to work with the people too. So it wasn't just one person, it was everybody working together. So
it was a big crew. I think when we were talking earlier, I think you once described being superintendent as being the mayor of a city.
We had 350 employees, but they weren't all in the cannery. There was very, because we had six guys in the beach gang, we had five carpenters, we had 12 cooks and waitresses, we had seven people working in the office, and you know, I don't know if those numbers are exact, but you know, that's, we had people a lot all over the place, you know. We just didn't have 350 people in the cannery, you know. But I could, if I had my paperwork here, because I think they threw it away, I hope they didn't, I could tell you exactly how many it took to run each line. So at the beginning of the season, you'd get all the information from Food and Drug, fish and game, on the prediction of the run. So then you'd go back and you'd have to try to guess, and that it was a guess. We'd have money bets on the size of the fish. So that meant how many pounds of fish were going to be. So you have to figure out how many days of processing and how many fishing periods you were going to get. So how many pounds of fish, so that you had to go through and figure out how many cans you're going to need. Okay, you got a slimer. Okay, what's he put on his hands? Gloves, right? How many pairs of gloves do you wear in the 12-hour period? Okay, you have to figure that out, and you multiply that by how many cannery kids you got working on the canning line. How many canning lines you're going to run that year? 2.5, or 1.5, or 2, you know? And so, you know, you had to go, you had to have aprons for everybody. You had to have boots for everybody. You had to have hair nets for everybody. And the machinist had to have earplugs for everybody. And, you know, there's things like that. But then that's when the superintendent come around and he saw somebody that didn't have their hairnet on or didn't have that. They got in trouble. So, but I always had support too. So it wasn't just me being, I don't know, God or whatever you want to call him. But, you know, my cannery people would see me being politely asking them where their hairnet was or something like that. And if they didn't have it, they had to go back and get it. So my machinists that were standing right behind me heard me talking to the kids that way. And the kids on the line heard me talk. In fact, a lot of times I'd go down and patch on the patching table along with the kids. You know, and I'd make sure I had my hairnet and my hat on and stuff like that, and my gloves. And of course, I didn't have boots, you know. Well, I had boots, but, you know, they were rubber like fur and then leather for other one. I don't know exactly what they were called, but that's what I wore. And, but, you know, I didn't really. There was one guy I really had problems with, and that was when I first started out. And I thought he stole. We had these great, big, beautiful clocks that we had for the retorts. And they keep time, and they were hand-wound. And I don't know exactly what the names are with it, but they were like big ship clocks. And I swore this guy swiped it. And I ended up firing him. And so I was getting ready to send him out, and he was across my desk, and I was talking to him, and I had his cash advance to go home, and I had it sitting right there, and I said, "This is your cash advance." And about that time, the radio went off, and of course, I had to go in there and talk. And about 10 minutes later, I come back, and the guy's sitting there, and no money. I says, "What'd you do? Put that money in your pocket?" No, I didn't do it. Anyway, I didn't want to do it. So anyway, I got him on the airplane, Penn Air, or no, I think it was Tibbetts came and picked him up, because it was Georgie that went, and Georgie followed him, and he said, "Gary," because I give him $100 bills, you know, $200 bills. And Georgie said he went and cashed one of those $100 bills at the store when after we dropped him off while he was waiting for the plane in King Salmon to go out. So I felt better, so there's nothing I could do about it at that time. But yeah. At least I know exactly what happened. I thought I knew what happened, and I was going to fire him and prove me right. And of course, Georgie and I used to, he was, I think he's about the same age as I am. I'm not sure. And I know a couple times we went down to Port Hyden or down that neck of the woods, and we'd fly back about dusk, and we'd fly below the high tide line. I mean, we were right on the deck. The wheels were almost in the sand, it seemed like. And we did that about, maybe twice a year, just to get out of the cannery there for a while. So. But other than that, he'd come in and take our people out, and well, all the pilots were great people. So
really, right? You worked very closely with all your workers, and I remember the story that you like to have share dinner or lunch or dinner with the Filipino crew, right?
Oh yeah, I used to always do that. In fact, they tried to segregate the Filipinos from the white people, and
there were separate mess
halls. Yeah. And so a lot of the college kids would go down and eat with the Filipinos, and so I went down there one day, and I says, okay, here's the deal. I cannot authorize you guys to have your own dining room here. And then you got kids coming in and eating too. I said, this is strictly a no-no with all my bosses. Okay, here's the deal. If I hear one word from anybody, I'm going to close it down. And I says, fill my plate. So I sat down and we had dinner, and I never had any complaints from the Filipinos or from the college kids that used to go down there and eat all the time. And they, one big happy family. That's the way it was. And so, you know, a lot of times I'd go down there and eat, because, you know, we had the blue room is where the superintendent and the bookkeeper and all those people ate. And they were, had not a cafeteria, but they had waitresses in the blue room. Well, but usually by the time I got down there, everybody was done in the blue room, and I didn't want to eat with the fishermen, because the fishermen would come in after the half hour. That's when they'd let them in to start eating. And then the other room where the machinists and the quality control people and beach gang and carpenters and all that would, what they referred to as the pink room, they were usually long gone too, because they wanted to get back to the bunkhouse and catch a half hour nap. You know, everybody did that. I mean, you ate as fast as you could and then catch a nap until you had to go back to work. And I'm not, that's the way I was raised and that's the way I started. So, you know, it didn't bother me. But so I would go down, and because the Filipinos, they had certain guys that would linger behind and clean up. And, you know, and they would come up early and prepare the meals, you know, cook the rice and stuff like that. We had a Filipino cook, and then usually we had at least one helper to help him. And I don't know if that was ever approved by all my bosses, but that's the way I did things. And they would come out and fix me dinner, and I enjoyed it. And I know my daughter ate down there more than one time. She was down there probably all the time, and a lot of the other people. But it was just, like I say, it was one big, we had our squabbles, don't get me wrong, but it was basically a happy family, mm-hmm. You know. The only time we had real squabbles was during the volleyball games, you know, when it was side out. I know that was out, you know, stuff like that.
I was just getting to that, because one of the things you'd have to do is keep this crew busy and happy when before the season began,
right,
or if the fish come in late, yeah. or the run is weak, or yeah. or there's a fisherman's price dispute or something.
Well, basically, none of that stuff really happened. What we really was trying to keep them busy was preseason. You know, they'd come in and we'd build eggs boxes for 8 hours a day, and do the cleanup. You know, I'd make the people that worked in the cannery to come in and help clean up. You know, scrub everything down and stuff like that. And we'd do painting. You know, they'd paint the machines and stuff like that. And it just, you know, basically find an odd job for them, you know, have them cut grass, pick up garbage. You know, in fact, I used to always make sure there was some garbage out when I was walking down the boardwalk. I'd make sure I picked it up and everybody could see me throwing in a garbage can. Because, you know, you see the superintendent do that, a lot of people would follow order. So, but, you know, a lot of this is just pure bragging on my part.
So. There's nothing wrong with that, Gary. Don't worry. But the volleyball tournament became famous, right?
Oh yeah. Well, the first year we had it, we had you know, five-man teams, and every time a touch went on the other side, there had to be at least one, you know, you get three touches on the side. And out of those three touches, one of them had to be a woman. So there was a woman on every team. And we put in, I forget how much, it was 25, 30 bucks, maybe a little bit more. And the money was going to go to the winners. And so we had a Johnson, Superintendent Dunkers was our team name. And I think we had about 10 or 12 teams in this volleyball tournament. And we had three nets in a big boat warehouse. And if the ball went up and hit in the rafters, it was a live ball. So if it hit the rafter and came down on your side, it was side out against you. Or if it went on the other side, it was side out against him. But it was a live ball, even though it hit the rafters. And so we got done. We didn't win, of course, but the fishermen won the tournament. And I think I've told this story a million times, but we got up there to present the trophy. We had a homemade trophy for the fishermen. And I don't know exactly where it is, but it is around here somewhere. And we presented the trophy to the third and fourth place team and second. And then I presented the trophy to the fishermen, the one. And then I had an envelope with our money in it. And there must have been $400 or $500 in there, maybe more. And so I went, and this is where KDLG came in. And I says, okay, this is the money for the winners of the volleyball tournament, but we are going to donate this money to the South Naknek Children's Fund, Christmas Fund. And so I gave the money. It wasn't Junior at that time. I think it was either Clyde or maybe it was Carville that I gave it to, Carville Senior. And so they still have the same, call it the same thing, the South Naknek Christmas Fund. And the fisherman's jaws just went, what'd he do? What'd he do? But I heard maybe one person say something right at that moment. But to this day, I have never heard one bad thing about what I did.
Yeah.
So.
You had the tournament every year, though, right?
Yeah, every year. Yeah. Until I was gone, then I don't know what happened then.
Right.
They did things different when I wasn't there.
I remember seeing the trophy in the mess hall.
Oh, is that where it was?
I think so. It's still there, right? Yeah. And with the names every year of the team that won,
mm-hmm.
So it was really remembered.
Yeah, I don't think the Super Dupers ever won it.
Was that your team?
Yeah,
the Super Dupers. I love it.
But usually, I'd had more than one woman on my team.
Tell me about the technological changes that you saw while you were superintendent. I mean, I can think of some, and the one I'm kind of interested in, you know, talk about this. It didn't involve your cannery, but it had to do with the conversion from three-piece cans to two-piece, and the botulism problems that affected other canneries that made this change.
Yeah, well, we. Well, when you say two-piece can or three-piece can, well, we were one of the first cans that went to a two-piece can. And basically, it was like a Dixie cup with a lid on it.
Right.
And then they nested together. And when they came off the machines, they're just like, you know, on a spiral. And they just dropped down one lid at a time. We had the same problem as everybody else. You know, we had to go through and certify all the stuff. And of course, we had our machinists that always checking the seams on the cans. They were, and the quality control, that was one of their big jobs, was checking the seams. I forget the timing on it, but I think it was every 2 hours that they'd have to go through and get a sample on every machine that was running and tear them down and take the seams. And of course, my machinist, like Harvey Henry, was in the main, he was the first machinist, so he was in the cannery. So he was constantly tearing down seams, checking them as we were processing during the day. And then what the machinist that was upstairs in the can, what they referred to as a can shop, he was doing the same thing. He was tearing down cans up there and looking at seams. So, you know, everybody was looking and conscious of what was going on. And, you know, and here's the biggest detector there is of what a good can of fish is supposed to smell like. So
he's pointing to his nose just for, but that's true. Are there other any other technological changes that you can think of?
Well, we had a brand new seamer, and it ran 600 cans a minute. A normal seamer in the, even the present day probably, ran 230 cans a minute. That's as fast as they would run, because the
and the seamer
clinches the lid on it,
and it crimps it around it. Yeah,
right. The seamer would only run 230 cans a minute. Well, the clincher ahead of it that put the lid on it ran 230 cans a minute. The machine, the filler, ran 230 cans a minute. Everything ran 230 cans a minute. So Gary comes in, he gets a new, brand new machine that runs 600 cans a minute. We got a little problem, right? So what we did is we took two lines of 230 cans a minute and ran them into the one seamer. And so it ran pretty good. We had a few problems at the beginning of the season, but my machinists, they were good guys, and we ended up, and to be honest with you, after it really started running, you know, I forgot about it, to be honest with you. But where we saw this is we went to Rainier Brewery. And this is where we, Continental Can was the ones that supplied our canneries, or cans for the cannery. And Continental Can also supplied the beer cans for Rainier. So we wanted to see one of these high-speed seamers and see how they work. So they took us down there. My machinists, there was Bob Deere, Harvey Henry, Mick Conley, and we were all went down there. There was about five of us, and we went through this cannery, and here they are just running cans as fast as we couldn't visualize 600 cans a minute, but they were running it. So we said, what happens when you get a jam? He says, we have a lot of beer all over the place. Because, you know, that's, you end up having a jam no matter what, you know. It's just common nature. It's something's going to happen. And so that's when we asked the head brewmaster, he says, if you were going to buy beer, what kind of beer would you buy? And he says, see that line right there where it's coming out of that faucet or spigot into those bottles? He says, that's where I take it out right there and take it home. He says, that's what you call the best beer there is. That's fresh.
That's a great story. Yeah. One of the changes, and I know that happened during the time that you've been with the industry, was the development really of the egg house and the egg product. Because beforehand, the eggs were thrown away,
basically. Yeah.
But this created a whole new sector for the industry and profit for the company.
Yeah. Well, our, you know, the, all the egg buyers are came in were Japanese, and so they would come in and they would oversee the egg operation, you know, the quality and how they were packed and the weight and stuff like that. And that's why I say, when I had Bob Sasaki and Yuki Iwata, who were both Japanese Americans, one of them was my egg crew supervisor and the other one was my fish house supervisor, which the eggs went from the fish house to the egg house, but both of them could speak Japanese. And so when we had interpreters there, or these technicians, they could talk to them and say, okay, what do we do to make this right? What do you need us to do to help out? And so that's, I didn't get involved with it because I had people that I hired that spoke the language and they knew a heck of a lot more than I did. So let them do the job. And they did. And it paid me dividends year in and year out. Because the first thing they did, they had a big group of technicians come over from Japan and they wanted to see our cannery. And they didn't talk to me. They talked to Bob and Yuke. You know, well, I shouldn't say that. Yeah, they did talk to me, but not specific, you know, how we do this thing or whatever. They knew that if they told me what to do, it would get done, but they were the ones that were responsible to make sure it was done and done the right way. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about some of the other people who worked at the cannery who you remember, particularly some of the local residents of South Naknek or Naknek, who Avid Carville and, yeah, and Junior.
Well, all of them, I hired almost all the people in South Naknek worked for me in what they call the spring fall crew. They worked in the spring, getting the boats ready, getting the bunkhouses, get the water in, making sure they were cleaned up, getting grub on the table, helping the early boats get in there. And we had a ways down at Diamond O, so we pulled tenders down there, so they went down there and launched the tenders in the springtime, and they patched piling. You know, if we had the ice, would take out a few piling. They would, if it was just one or two, the spring fall crew would do it, but if not, my beach gang would have to do it. It was a bigger hole, and they would just, you know, get the sewer system hooked up, ready to go. My spring fall crew, they did everything, you know, and
are these people who would actually during the peak of the salmon season go out fishing?
Yep, none of them would stay at home. Well, Carville did. Well, he was one of the top fishermen. But some of the younger kids, they would work, but almost all of them would go fishing during the season. You know, come fishing season, there goes the spring fall crew. But they would be back, you know, in the fall when we're getting ready to pull the boats and put them all away and winterize all the bunkhouses and put antifreeze in all the toilets and making sure everything wouldn't freeze. There they were. They were there waiting for us. And those are the guys we played basketball against, you know. They were mean. Boy, mean is right.
But they filled a labor need for the cannery,
yeah,
without having to bring people in.
Oh, yeah. No, I had one of the biggest spring-fall crews. Well, not biggest, but more effective, I should say. And, you know, they'd have to go into the boilers at the beginning of the season and a patch where the bricks had fallen off and stuff like that. And the manhole that they had to crawl through to get in there, and you know how big a boiler is, and you know, you could get claustrophobia in there. Well, Junior was the one that used to have to go in there all the time until he got too big. Then he couldn't go in there. So I don't know what happened after I left, who they got to go in there or whatever, because I was not concerned about it. You know, I didn't want anything to know about it or anything like that, because I put in my time and it hurt me to know what was going on. And, you know, those people were too special for me. So, but the spring fall crew, they were well worth the weight in gold, so.
A lot of women worked at the cannery in different roles.
Oh yeah, yeah. There were forklift drivers, waitresses, head cooks, but baker. My head baker was a woman. Her name, she was a station agent for Alaska Airlines down in Port Hyden, her and her husband. Her husband worked towards me as a provision man, and she worked as a baker. And she'd make 100 loaves of fresh bread a day, minimum. That's not counting all the desserts and stuff like that. And apple crisp for the superintendent, that when he missed about the third or fourth meal, all of a sudden apple crisp would start showing up on my office desk. So, because during the season, I probably missed almost every day, maybe all the meals. And I would make midnight meal. Because midnight meal, we used to, you know, they tried different things. You know, midnight meal. Okay, what do you serve in midnight meal? What we found out is you serve breakfast at midnight. And we had never had any problems after that. Because we used to have steaks and pork chops and all that stuff. It was just too heavy. People didn't want to eat that before they went to bed. So we started having breakfast, you know, cold cereal, fruit, vegetables, eggs and whatever. And people were happy. So, and then they'd go to bed, and of course they had to get up early in the morning because they had to be there on the line by 8 o'clock, or machinists had to be there ready to go before 5 or 6, you know, sometimes to get the machines ready to go for the day. Time they greased them and oiled them and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Teachers as employees, they are a labor pool that's also available now during the summer.
Yeah, right. As that was some of my key people were school teachers, principals of high schools. And some of them, I started when I was there between the time I was in Aggieyik and finally spent a couple years down here before I go to Naknek. I had baseball teams in Blaine. And all those kids on those baseball team, we took and won the championship over in Linden one year. And every one of those kids on that baseball team ended up working in my cannery, except for one. And while the principal of the high school, his son, I see him every once in a while, and he still remembers me taking him up there and having him drive forklift all the time. He drove forklift on the beach gang, so he did the taking the piling back and forth and stuff like that, heavy work. But yeah, the teachers, it was great because while they were going to school, they would be in the cannery working, and they would kind of be promoting themselves up the ladder, and then they would get done with their schooling, they'd go find a teaching job. Well, how many teachers work during the summertime? Where do they work? They work at the cannery. It was a great job for them. So they came back, and, you know, like I told you, some of my teachers worked for me for 16 years. I mean, time you get your schooling, your 4 or 5 years of school, and then when they first get out of school, they have their fifth year they have to put in, and then they get their job. You know, 16 years is not very long, really, when you talk about all the schooling that some of these people had to go through. So,
As superintendent, what kind of relationship did you have with the fishermen? They stayed at the cannery bunkhouses, right?
Depends on what you call the fishermen. we had a bunkhouse for fishermen, and they would, when they weren't fishing, they'd buy meal tickets and they'd eat in the mess hall. And they would, so the cannery crew would say, eat at 5 o'clock at night, and then the fishermen were allowed to come in at 5:30, and then they would eat their meal. And they ate the same meal as the cannery people did. There was no discrepancy, no difference. Same thing that my Filipinos, they ate the same food as everybody else, but with the blue room people ate the same room as the food as the pink room people. And except I didn't, because most of the time I wasn't there. But anyway, at the fishermen, I think I'm not really saying, but I think I had a good relationship with all the fishermen. There was very few of them that I didn't have a problem. Because if they had problems, guess who they had to come to? If they needed parts from Seattle, guess who they had to come to? Well, stockroom man would do it, but of course I had to authorize everything that was going on. And so we would get this stuff. You know, we had 600 boats. So how many parts do you need for 600 boats during the course of the season? And, you know, let's see, it was one of the Angusons. Oh, it was Fred Anguson, I think. We went in for a whim. My stockroom and I were figuring out, Guy and I were figuring out things to buy to sell at the cannery. So we got smoke alarms, carbon dioxide. So we got a couple and we sold a few to the fishermen, and one of them was Ted Anguson. And he came in to me and he said, "Gary, there's something wrong with my smoke detector." I said, "What's wrong?" He says, "It keeps going off every once in a while. I have to take it and turn it on." And so finally I says, "Hey, here's the deal. You got a problem." I says, "You go get your boat and bring it in and we'll pull it up and I'll have the mechanics take a look at it." So he did, and we found a small leak in the exhaust system and it saved his life. And that's how come the Angusons and Gary Johnson get along together. Because, you know, he told all of his brothers, you know, Ted Angusons and Trefon Angusons, you know, they were usually kind of on the outskirts when I took over as a bookkeeper, because they didn't see too much with Alaska Packers and stuff like that. But over the years, for me, I told Trefon one day, I said, "Trefon, this is the way it is. I'm going to be here as long as you. So if you don't like it, tell me now, because that's the way it's going to be." And so he and I became pretty good friends over the course of, you know, 10 years that we went back and forth. So, because he ended up a big monkey in the
Native Corporation.
Yeah, Native Corporation. And so, you know, he would always come down and say hi at the beginning of the season and stuff like that, you know. He never did before, but after that, you know, we weren't buddy buddies, you know, or anything like that, but we were friends, we'll put it that way. We would never say anything bad about either of us.
Right.
Always tried to keep everything on the positive side, so.
There were difficult times with fishermen, though, and I'm thinking in the early 80s when there were price disputes and the like. Were you as superintendent involved, or?
Well, most of that time, no. You know, during the Rockness era, he did it. So I was just a bookkeeper. I would talk to the fishermen and show them exactly where they were making a bad mistake, not accepting what they were getting offered, you know. I was more on the fisherman's side than my cannery side. And then after that, when I became a superintendent, I didn't worry about it because Bunren's the one that set the fish price, not me, you know. So what he did, I had to support, and, you know, he said, "Well, we're paying $1.25 for this fishing period, you know, that's..." So I tell my fish clerk, "You're paying $1.25. You know, it was, I just had to make sure that I was making enough profit on my canned salmon to cover $1.25. So, and sometimes it was kind of hairy because, like I say, at the beginning of the season, you know, I had to figure out how many gloves, how many slimy knives I'm going to need for the crew, how many cans I was going to put up, how much fish I need, the price of the fish, so I had a different scale for different prices. So basically, I knew if I was going to make money before I even got to the cannery, based on the information I had. And like I say, a lot of my information was from experience. You know, I'd bet with Fish and Game, the size of the fish. To me, that was as important as how many fish we were getting, was the size. Because if a 5.2 fish and a 4.9 fish, there's a lot of difference when you're putting them in a can. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a half pound right there. And half pounds were big sellers. So, you know, it made a difference.
What kind of relationship did you have with Fish and Game, the University of Washington scientists and the like who regulated the fishery?
Well, I think I had a unusual relationship with all of them, because Fish and Game, what I do is at the beginning of the season, you know, they'd have certain things that they would tell me what they wanted done and stuff like that. I say, fine. And so I'd go up there, and the first thing we'd do was be to bet on the size of the run. A bet, money on the table, the size of the run. The second bet was the size of the fish, whether they were right or I was wrong. But you know what the size of the bet was? A nickel. Nothing more than a nickel. We always, that nickel became big deal. And so, you know, if Food and Drug, the Fish and Game people, they were always welcome at my place, you know, and they came down, and we always tried to get our reports in as soon as we could. We always pride ourselves to be number one, to, you know, to get it in first. And we always try to cooperate with those people.
Yeah. You mentioned the name Ole Mathiesen.
Oh, yeah, from the University of Washington.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was, what was it, 95? I was in a boating accident in Florida. And I spent, lost a year from a prop of the boat. And I died three times, once on the hospital, once on the way to the first hospital. No, once on the dock, once on the way to the first hospital, once to the way to the second hospital. So I died three times in about 6 or 8 hours, something like that. So I was down there, and the reason I was down there, I was visiting somebody. I won't say who she was, but she was. Anyway, I was down there, and the University of Washington had an airplane down there, and they found out that I was in the hospital, and so they took me in a stretcher and put me on the university airplane and sent me back, because Ole said to do it, Ole Mathiesen, because we worked with him, you know, same as I did with Fish and Game. You know, I didn't bet with Ole on the side of the fish, but, you know, that was one of the things we always talked about, but because to me, it was important to know the size of the fish, because I had to know, or I tried to guess, because it made a big difference on how I geared up the cannery and how many cans I would buy and how much salt I'd have to buy and stuff like that. But most of it was hindsight, but you know, you have to have some professional input every once in a while. So we always enjoyed, and Ole he used to come and talk to the industry, and then I, you know, hang around and kind of pick his brain and stuff like that. So
yeah,
but he was a neat guy, really a neat guy, knew his business.
Yeah. Tell me this. You said earlier that sometimes you didn't see eye to eye with some of the other cannery bosses, or not the bosses, but your bosses.
Well, I can't say anything about that, and I don't want to, because they, you know, it's just, I was taught one way, and sometimes they were taught different, and I thought, like everybody else, you know, my way is the right way, because I thought I was taught by some of the best people in the industry, and I respected that, and I didn't want to let them down, because they took a raw rookie out of the woods and made a superintendent out of him, and I didn't want to spoil their reputation. So it was hard sometimes. You know, you get people that you've been around long enough, and you know that there's things that happen within the industry and the fishing grounds that whatever happens, you have no control over. And so, and unless you're there, you don't know what happened. I mean, so I remember one time I had some fish that came in from the cannery, well, off of one of the boats, and it wasn't very good. And I called up my boss and I says, this stuff is bad, I'm gonna dump it. And oh no. So we put it in the fish house and I started going through, okay, we get one that way and three that way, one that way, three that. And we took care of, and I think out of about 30,000 pounds of fish, we saved about 10, you know, not 10,000, but 10 fish. Right. But, you know, it, like you say, unless you were there and actually smelled the fish, you know, you can't, well, they were only on the boat for a few hours, but they were enough to make them bad. And that's why, you know, nowadays you got refrigeration and all the boats are, you know, I mean, not just ice and water. I mean, talking chargers and everything like that. Mm-hmm. It's completely different than when I was there. So.
Tell the story about Chuck Bundren and his helicopter.
Oh, Chuck. Okay, Chuck was my boss when I worked for Alaska Packers. And he used to... No, he was my boss when I worked for Alaska Packers, but he was Trident at that time.
Right.
And he would, I went and stole some of his fishermen one year. About, I think there was 10 of his Highliners. I mean, Highliners. And they were tied up in my dock right there by the port shop. And they were all sitting there drinking beer. And Chuck came and landed his helicopter on my finger pier. And he walked around, I didn't see him again, but anyway, he went down the ladder to talk to his fishermen, but they weren't at that time, they were my fishermen. And so anyway, he went down there and talked to him and stuff like that, and he throwing beer cans over on the mud at low water. And so number one, I kicked Chuck off the dock. Number two, I made the fishermen get down on the dig and pick up all the beer cans. And the next thing I knew was the year was over and we were merging with Trident Seafoods, Chuck Bundren and me. So Chuck came over and he looked at me and he had a meeting with all the superintendents from Alaska Packers. And he looked at me and he says, he says, now I can land my helicopter on your dock. I says, Chuck, you got to remember, it's not my dock anymore, it's your dock. So, I don't know if that meant anything, but I went and built a finger pier, put a helicopter pad out there for the first year. The second year we had two helicopters, so I had to have another helicopter pad up by the office up on the top of the hill, which was right next to the gin mill, or the pit. And the kids would always just play around that neck of the woods. And I was worried about the kids and the helicopter coming in and landing, even though I know that they would be real cautious if there were any of the kids were around and stuff like that. But that didn't save a kid if a blade hits them. So what I did is I had a mother's meeting of all the ladies from South Naknek in the mess hall. We had cake and coffee and stuff like that. And I explained to them that here we have to have two helicopters this year, and I built a helicopter pad up by the office. I says, and I don't want any of the kids to get hurt. I says, what are we gonna do? That's the last word I said. To this day, I don't ever remember that particular year having any kids come down there. Because if they got even partway, they didn't have just one mother. They had 30 mothers after them. And I didn't have to say a thing. I didn't have to talk to the ladies or anything like that. They took care of everything themselves. Hi, Benjamin.
Good doing a little interview with Gary. So.
Hello.
Let me ask, you mentioned that you were able to steal some fishermen away from Chuck Bunn. How do you go about stealing fishermen?
Well, what you do is you go down and talk to him and ask him to deliver to you.
Right.
And that's what he did. He went down there and talked to him to go back and deliver back to him. Well, they honored their word, and they delivered the fish to me that one year, but the next year they went right back to Chuck. And I think that was about the year that we got in the yelling match with Chuck, and then we ended up merging after that. So,
what's your favorite memory from working as superintendent or bookkeeper at South Naknek?
My favorite memory is working with mothers of South Naknek about the kids and the helicopters, and not have to say a damn thing. You know, the mothers took care of it, and you know, I supported them, and I think that's my fondest memory. But I had so many memories, it's hard to say. You know, I just couldn't remember any of this stuff.
But it was a good profession. It was a challenging job.
Yeah, it was very challenging, but it was very rewarding. That was the big thing, was the reward. You know, everybody would come up and say, what a good job you did. And I was needed. You know, if I had a fisherman out there, I remember one time I was sitting there getting ready. I don't know, I was getting ready to, I had the radios in my office and my house and everything like that. And all of a sudden, somebody comes on the radio, a lady says, Gary, my husband is having a heart attack. She didn't give call letters or say where she was or anything like that. But based on the information that I had, I knew who she was because I had recruited them a couple of years ago. She was from, I don't know if they were from Homer, but they were from that neck of the woods down there. And I got a hold of Tim, and I had her get over to one of the big tenders that we had that Tim could land on. So we sent the helicopter down, and Tim went and picked the guy up and brought him back to the clinic on the north side. And thank God it was not a heart attack or anything like that. He was just passing the gallstone. And now you understand that really hurts. And so she panicked, and you know, that's all she would talk about the rest of the year.
But so, she called you.
Yeah, no call letters. I had no idea where she was, but you know, I asked her what tenders are in the vicinity, and she named, you know, she could see them because she was down there. They were in the line to deliver fish. Mm-hmm. So that's why I knew exactly where she was, because I sent the tender down there to pick up the fish. So
you had a long and successful career with APA and later Trident, and it was pretty in a unique area like South Naknek.
Well, we had multiple, you know, we had ConAgra was in there too.
Right.
I had them a couple of years, and I still to this day I can't, just before we were bought out by Sea Alaska. Maybe that was Sea Alaska we bought. It was ConAgra and then Sea Alaska, and then that's when we were in the battle with Trident. We were Sea Alaska, and then we became Trident. So yeah, I think it was Sea Alaska.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but it was a great career, and it was a tremendous amount of work and jobs, and it's really interesting hearing your discussion about, I mean, the personal relations with the cannery workers, the mothers in the town, you know?
Well, I still, you know, Katie's working on these projects, and some, you know who's giving her a lot of the information? Bob Deere, who was my cannery foreman, and you know, and let's see, Bob, Bill McKay, who was my stockroom man, you know, that people just, they kind of are on the way back and they're trying to help her out as much as I was trying to, you know, help them out in their tough times. But they were a lot of really neat people, you know.
Can you tell the story about when your daughter almost got you fired?
She always did that. She, when she was young, you know, I think she was between 12 and 15 years old. Maybe she was 15 to 16, but she wasn't 18. And she would sneak down to the egg house and either be packing eggs or whatever. And my bosses would go down there and see her, and they knew she wasn't old enough. And they'd come up there and say, yell at me. And so I had to go down and say, Katie, you can't do that. You can't go down there and work. So she said, okay, Dad, I won't do it. Well, she had Yuki Wada and Bobby Sasaki strung right around their little thumb. And first thing I know, she'd be back in the egg house. So I'd go down there and I'd see her, and I'd just kind of look around the other way and walk out. But they said, okay. So when my bosses show up, they had a sign that Katie was supposed to go and run up into the loft where all the boxes were and stay up there until they left. And then she'd come back down and pack eggs. So they were against me, all of them. Against me and for me, I guess. I don't know exactly what you would call it, but it was funny to a certain extent.
Yeah. Is there anything else, anything I missed, anything you'd like to say, anything?
No, but I appreciate what you guys are doing. I really do. I mean, I kind of cracked up a couple of times talking about people. You know, when we were at the down at the train station and stuff like that, because it hurts me right here. And what I know what Katie is doing, and it pleases me to all end that they remember the cannery and the people. To me, it wasn't the cannery, it wasn't the job, it wasn't the pay or anything like that. It was the people. And that's what I enjoyed. Friendship, you know. A lot of times we disputed, you know. We didn't see eye to eye on everything, but at the end of the day, we normally did. But there was always, you know, we got together as well at the end of the season as friends. You know, we'd have a beer at the end of the season. Well, sometimes it was before the end of the season, but you know, but.
Yeah, there was one thing that I forgot to ask. Oh, after such an intense job that lasted for several months, it all comes to an end. What do you do when you went back home?
Okay, I fly home usually the first part of August, and I would meet my wife at the helicopter or at the airport, and we'd go play golf. And then we'd stay overnight in Seattle and play golf the next morning. And then we'd go back to Blaine. And what I would do is I'd walk into my bedroom, I'd take my watch, take it off, and put it on the counter. And I wouldn't even pretend to look at it until 1st of August, September, October. Yeah, usually middle October, I'd put my watch back on. And then all of a sudden they would say, well, where have you been, Gary? And I said, well, it's about time to get ready. We got another canning season, we got to go. So I sat down and said, okay, how many gloves we need? How many rubber gloves do we need? How many slimy knives do we need? And I start, you know, how many fish are we going to catch? Oh, you mean you don't know? So I have to call a fishing game, you know? So it was just, but I didn't even pretend to go to work there for a couple times. I know I got chewed out a couple times, but I was at the point then, you know, at the end of the season, after a long season, you know, sometimes I didn't give a damn. You know, and I figured I had enough support from my people that they would have a hard time replacing me. Anybody can be replaced, don't get me wrong. But I just figured it would be just too hard because I knew what entailed the job and I knew how to do it. And to me, it was easy. And I had people that made my job easier that I could rely on. I mean, I had people in key positions that made my job a piece of cake. So, you know, putting this cannery together, it was, yes, it was hard, but I knew who to deal with, you know. You know, say you belong to a co-op or something like that, you could get me canned goods, you know. So you got my cans, next guy would give me the salt and stuff like that. And then we had lists from all my machinists at the end of the season. One thing they had to do was fill out what they needed for the next year. And, you know, how many, you know, screwdrivers they needed or what. Well, they had to furnish their own tools, but, you know, well, say, you know, they needed something for the particular part of their shop or something like that. And they had fill out all that stuff and before we left. And my stockroom man, I would go through all that stuff before we left. See, that's what I was doing at the end of the season when we were only canning maybe 3 hours a day or 4 hours a day. I was signing paychecks, getting the people out, and the stockroom man and I would sit down and, in the old days, sit down there and smoke cigarettes in his, and go through all the stuff that we needed for the next season, but and drink coffee. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's great. Larissa, do you have any questions or any thoughts?
I guess my question would be, you've talked a lot about the family environment of all of the workers and those relationships, but that doesn't sound like that presence was necessarily there before, and there was some of these segregation issues, you know, with the Filipino mess hall being separate. Can you talk a little bit about some of those changes in some of the other buildings that you kind of brought with your presence?
Actually, you know, the only families we really had up there, because I didn't let my family go after the first season. It was just too hard on them. But usually we had, like, my first machinist, his wife came up. And she worked in the mess hall as a waitress. And but that were not too many families. The families were the ones that lived in the village. It was the only families we really had at the cannery. We had like Carville's wife, she worked for the laundry for me. You know, and he ended up being a winterman. Well, he wasn't the winterman when I was there. He became winterman after I left. His brother was my winterman when I was there. And Carville Sr. was the winterman. So, but Shirley, you know Shirley Zimmon, yeah, she worked for me in the laundry. And she's the one that I'd send to Anchorage to get my flowers for my flower beds. So.
But were you familiar with a discussion of segregation issues, whether between the Filipino crew, the white crew, the college crew, Mexican, whoever, and the like?
Oh yeah, well, I spent all winter going to all that stuff all the time. I'd fill out reports. It was a pain in you know what, because I didn't have that problem. We had Filipinos? Yes, we had Filipinos. But we had white guys right next to them, Filipinos, working. And eating. They're all eating in the same mess hall. The college kids, white college kids, were eating the mess hall with the Filipinos. I sat there and ate with the Filipinos in the same mess hall. My daughter ate with them. You know, I just never, yes, we had natives there, but they worked in spring fall. They fished. I couldn't get them to work in the cannery to save their soul, except spring fall and they fished for me, and that was fine. They didn't want to work in the canneries, and I didn't want to force them. And so, but other than that, you know, we had no what you would call any natives, because they were, everybody was working at the cannery, or they were fishing for me. So, you know, we just never really had what I call any segregation problems. So, because I, maybe some of the stuff that goes on nowadays, we just didn't have that problem. I mean, we just didn't have, segregation wasn't a problem. I mean,
yeah, that's great. I just wondered if you'd seen it while you were a superintendent.
Well, I did, but I says, hey, we're not going to have it. You either do it this way and let everybody come in there and eat with you, or you don't, or I close it down. That's plain and simple. You have your Filipino mess hall, fine, but the college kids want to come in there and eat, they eat. If they don't. And if I hear anything or they get any problems, I'll close it down, plain and simple. And they knew that's what I would do. Because I think, I don't know, I think I told you I broke the union, Local 37. Yes, I had all the Filipinos, don't put this under anything, but I had promised all the Filipinos to, if they came back and worked for me, they would make more money than their buddies that worked for Local 37 at any of the other cameras. And so they did, and they used to not make egg boxes, but my Filipinos had to end up making egg boxes, but I paid them. Every time they pounded a nail on the egg box, they got paid. And before, they were on what they call guaranteed. I said, I don't have any guarantees for filling. You work, you get paid. That's your guarantee. And I says, if you don't work, you don't get paid. And sure enough, they went home that year. I didn't make a big deal of it. I paid them off at the end of the season what they earned. They came back. Every one of them came back the next season because they made more money than their buddies at Bumblebee or their buddies at Delboro or whatever. They made more money because we processed from 8 to midnight. They got a lot of overtime, and I didn't tell them that, but they earned it.
Talk about, I mean, the guarantee. Can you explain what that term meant as far as the workers being paid?
Okay, the Filipinos or Local 37, when I was up there, were once they worked in the fish house and the egg house and stuff like that, and some of the other jobs that were lesser important, but they were guaranteed so many hours a season, whether you worked one day or 100 days, they were guaranteed that amount of money. And so what they would do is at the beginning of the season, they wouldn't do it, they would say, oh, that's my guarantee money I'm working off. And so it, yeah, it's been so long, I really can't remember exactly how it worked, but all I know is I didn't pay any guarantees after that. Well, AFU had the same thing. They used to have guarantees with their cooks and the people that worked at, they had guaranteed so many hours. And so.
But you convinced them that they just keep working, they'll be paid for every hour that they work, and they'll make more than the guarantee.
Yeah, right. And I don't remember, I don't think I end up paying them more than the union scale anyway. So it just happened to work out, you know, that we ended up working more hours, so they got more pay. So.
The only other question I have is going back to your conversation kind of about the cannery functioning kind of like its own little city. And you talked about, you know, having to get the water lines fired up and everything down.
Yeah.
Something you haven't, and we've talked about food, but some of the other infrastructure needs that I think are important to talk about is how you're able to flick that switch and turn on the lights and...
Okay, well, that was the job of the spring fall crew. Mm-hmm. They were there, they lived in the village, so they could come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and work all day long. When they were done, they didn't have to go to the bunkhouse that had no running water or anything. They went home. They had water and stuff like that at home. So that's why I had the spring fall crew. They would get the bunkhouses ready to go. They would get the toilets ready, the showers, and they'd get the laundries. We'd get the beds made for the machinist crew, the machinist bunkhouse. They would clean it up and go through and make all the beds and get the pillows out and stuff like that. They'd take care of my place and the office girls' bunkhouse. They'd take care of them, the ladies, the bunkhouse, the women's bunkhouse. They'd take care of that one and all that stuff. Now, that was in the spring. In the fall, Shirley Zimmon, she would take all these bunkhouse and get all the sheets and blankets and everything like that and put them in a great big washer. You should see the size of that sucker. And she would wash them and get everything folded up. So in the spring, when everybody was doing all these jobs and making a bit, they had fresh linen. I mean, she worked in the fall, and that was her big job, was getting all the blankets ready to go and stuff like that. And you know, she'd always send me a list. Well, I mean, there's this many pillowcases and this many more sheets and this many more blankets. And not blankets, because most of the time they were those old army blankets. They were wool, and you couldn't destroy them with a gun. But it was just, if I had to take it, you know, I could sit hours finding different things that different people did that I hadn't, well, yes, I had the idea that what they were doing, but you know, now you wouldn't have any idea. Now, somebody come in there fresh in the canyon, they would have no idea what a spring fall crew would do. You have to have good people. You know, Freddie Grindle, Carvel, not Carvel Jr., but Senior, because you guys call him Carvel, I call him Junior, but you know, they had things that they had to do every spring, every fall. You know, they had to get certain things done, and before we could get the first barge coming in with our provisions. So you had to get the freezers down to temperature, have to get the wash machines and dishwashers work. All the washing, we had two wash machines and each floor in each bunkhouse. And you know, so every year we had to make sure they were all working at the beginning of the season. And then, of course, we always had spare enough because, you know, 18-year-old kids working in canneries, they don't know how to do laundry. They would destroy them as fast as we could keep them in going, it seemed like. But spring fall crew was very important, very important. And I think if you talk to Katie, she understands too, mm-hmm. exactly what they meant. They meant to the canyon. Actually, they made my job easy because I would say, okay, I'm going to be there a certain day and I want this to be done when I get there. And basically I want a coffee and donuts. And as like I said, I went up there usually anywhere from 2 to 5 days early. Nobody else was in camp except me. And that's when I went, and Carvel and I would sit and walk. We'd walk all around the cannery, what we had to do, what he thought we had to do, what was during the winter, what would deteriorate, how many boards we lost, which ones we should be replacing, how many they replaced and hadn't got to the other ones, how many piling that he suggested we replace. And, you know, you go through and, you know, we got all the wash machines working, how many ordered did you order this year? And I said, well, I ordered the normal ones, about 6 or 8. He says, well, we can probably use 2 right off the bat, you know. And so he and I would walk around the cannery, and then we'd end up at the winter house. And like I say, we'd be smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and talking to Annie and the kids. And so, and Freddie Grindle, he was about yay big, it seemed like, and kind of heavy and meaner and cat shit, excuse my language. But he was the neatest guy I ever saw. But he was a mechanic like you wouldn't believe. He could fix anything. You know, you have an old D2 cat out there and is having problems. He go here, okay. Or the one of the big ones, and just real, real gentleman. You know, never a bad word said among us ever, unless, like I say, unless we were playing basketball. But it was, you know, just really a pleasure to work with those people. And the reason I did is when we were sitting down drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, I was told them everything. See, everything I did at the cannery, we had to have a budget for. You know, a capital budgets or just a regular working budget and stuff like that. So I'd sit down and I bring out this paperwork, and I says, okay, this is what I plan on doing this year. We've got to replace this particular machine. We're going to move this cannery from here to there. We're going to replace this. And, you know, and I'd let them feel what we're doing. We're not going to come in there and destroy your village or anything like that. We're going to come in there and try to make the cannery better for both you and us. And I want them to know exactly what we were trying to do or what we wanted to do that particular season, because every season's different. You have to, you know, because you, number one, you don't have time to do anything, because, you know, you go up there Mother's Day and then pretty soon it's fishing season starts on, you know, 1st of May, you know, you're talking, or all the herring boats are leaving. So what's that mean? That means all the machinists have to be working either on to get the boats ready to go, and the port engineers have to get them tuned up and ready to go. So there's a lot of work to be done before the season even starts, or even gets close to starting. So, and then, you know, the herring season kind of it used to be easy. We didn't have to worry too much. And then all of a sudden, herring, golly, this started May. We didn't even go up until in May. So.
That's a great story. Unless you have anything else, any other questions, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been a long time. Sorry for dragging this out.
No, it's not. Like my wife says, you get Gary talking, you talk your leg off. You start talking about canneries and stuff like that. Because, like I said, that's where my cannery is, right here.
Well, I appreciate it, and that's a great way to bring it to an end. But thanks again, Gary.
And, you're welcome very much.
Thank you. It has been a great weekend to spend with you.
Boy, your hand is warm. You know how to start a fire?
Yeah, it might be time to make some noise.
Yeah, I'll take this off.
Let's get a fire going.